Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. This isn't just about money. This is about life. And now the host of the Power of the Purse podcast, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. There was a time in my life not too long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise. And it was something I could not only understand but teach to other women. Too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better but didn't, until they were forced to, because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. This podcast will add another chapter to a rich history of successful women who, when faced with some personal challenges, found the ability to step beyond them. We'll examine some of the truths they made up about money from their life experiences and how that shaped the paths they chose. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Candida Cisak. Candida is the president and founder of CTS Associates, LLC. She's an innovative business advisor focusing on mid-sized companies. She specializes in enabling client growth and management success through internal executive teams and or advisory boards that support vision, innovation, change that supports operation, finance, and technology, and employee growth. Welcome, Candida.
I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. Let's start with a couple questions here about the business that you have. And I want to talk about the CTS for just a minute, because that's a business that you actually created yourself and have been involved in. But for how many years?
It started 14 years ago, and it slowly picked up speed.
Okay. And you did this because you actually were doing things like this, but found that there was a dramatic need for people to kind of up their game with the use of advisory boards, correct?
Well, the business was based on giving advice to growth companies, mostly the CEO. And then it comes to a time that you're advising, but you, besides bringing an expert to do certain work, they need to be surrounded by the pillars, experts that are in different pillars of the business, like operations, sales, finance, technology, whatever is needed. So I started building advisory board to continue to help the companies and their growth. And the advisory board are basically run very, very systematically. There's quarterly meetings, monthly conference calls, they're stipends, they're not free, and everybody's engaged in helping the client directly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
that's how it started. Most of my business comes from advising owners on the strategic end of building their company. So most of my clients are partners, family-owned businesses, second or third generation, sometimes founders.
Mm-hmm. And then you develop something, which we use the acronym for ELAB, Executive Leaders for Advisory Boards. So do you kind of have a group of people that are ready to operate when you say, I have a need for somebody who does X, Y, and Z? These people should become a part of this particular company's board. Have you already vetted these people?
Yeah, there's a vetting process. I chair and founded the organization. We have a board. We have a vetting process. I personally, I know all the members I brought in and how they got vetted, but the members' vision is to get to know each other, communicate, collaborate. Some of them have shared business. Some will be sharing other members being on boards of their clients. We're starting an outreach program because we're on our third year. Actually, we're on our fourth year. An outreach program. Mm-hmm. We do have a website. We do list our members, and the caliber is very high. I mean, we have COOs of $80 billion companies, and we have CEOs of $10 million companies. But it's all, and they're matched. The members are matched, so they can all work together, and we're not duplicating the profession. Example, okay. If there's a technology company, there might be two, but they can't be the same. If there's a law firm, there's two, but they can't be at the same specialty. Same thing with accounting. CEOs and CFOs of companies doesn't really matter, but when to the business owners that are there, it does matter that there isn't duplicates, so they can all support each other.
When you started this, how many people were in this group?
We started with 30 members. We have 45 members, and we're not going to go to more than 50 members.
How often do you meet? 30
members attend every other month. We have a meeting. So about 30 members show up every other month to attend.
That's a very innovative idea.
Yeah, we have speakers. Keeps mm-hmm. the conversation healthy.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Are there other people who do things like this?
Well, there are other people. There's internet advisory boards where you sign up and you pay monthly dues, and they try to find you a board to sit on, and then you choose whether you want to be on that board or not. There are different pockets of this kind of thinking. The fact that we are centralized to the Philadelphia and the 30-mile radius, and the clients are all going to be somewhere around this corridor. There's nothing mm-hmm. like that in Philadelphia. There's TAB, there's Vistage, there's C2. There's different kinds of organization that bring in CEOs to discuss their problems and share among their colleagues. But an advisory board is created solely for the company. So there isn't. It's advisors strictly understanding your business and helping you out. So,
and do members of ELAB who are on advisory boards, do they serve more than one advisory board at the same time?
Several of them do. Several of them also serve as board of directors, which is more, mm-hmm. it's a governance board as opposed to an advisory board, even though governance board give you advice. But it's mm-hmm. a much more formal, it's more liability and risk.
Yeah.
So some of them will belong to the NACD, National Association of Corporate Directors, but they've gotten to certain points they'd like to sit on advisory board, which are smaller companies than a corporate board sometimes.
Do these people, are they compensated when they're on the advisory boards?
Yes. We only build advisory boards. Now, if you sit on a nonprofit, that's your choice.
Yeah.
And you don't get paid on a nonprofit. You actually pay them to help them out.
Yeah.
But, there are times that I sat on a hospital board, I sat on a university board, and, you know, those are not paid position. You donate to those organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also sit when all those terms ended, I ended up building advisory boards with stipends to support the everybody buying into the process.
Mm-hmm. I love that idea. I just think that's a great way to do it. It's because so many people who are entrepreneurial, when they think of an advisory board, they think of a kind of parental oversight, you know, say, I think I'm doing this because I think I know how to do it myself. But mm-hmm. having done that myself, I have created advisory boards for my own business. And I found that the willingness to listen to what these people have to say is very different from having to do what they tell you to do. I mean, completely, it's your choice. It was an extremely important benchmark for me to say, it's time to get some advice from people outside of my own business. And the advice they gave me made a huge difference in my business for the good.
Yes.
So I love the idea of having advisory boards, and I wish that more people listening who might own businesses would consider doing something like this, because it's really a great connection from the outside world directly to your business. And I applaud you for doing this. I think that's a great idea.
To your point, it is extremely valuable. And the culture of who you bring in is very valuable, too. It has to be the right mix and the right culture.
And I don't know what magic you perform to do that, but more power to you.
Called a different expertise and a different talent, but go ahead.
Okay. There you go. Let me ask you something else. I know one of the things you said you're most proud of is you're helping other women, the success you've had with helping women business owners. Are there some in particular that stick out in your mind, and can you quantify what those success stories were?
Yes, and most women that I've helped, it's the ability to be able to sit with them, listen to what their story, their plight is, their journey is, and give them the wisdom and experience of time to help them basically jump whatever hurdles they're trying to jump or whatever problems they're trying to solve. This, about 3 years ago, had me create a group called WCXO, which really means Chief Women Officers, but it's a mix of women that are executives. Mm-hmm. And the group was formulated basically for that, for women to learn to help women. And it's purposely mixed with young women at 35 that might be partners or directors or some sort of management type of title or have their own company, to the older women that have been through certain experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So this way, I'm not just doing it by myself. Now I've created a network of women that are helping women. On my basis, I usually get connected because somebody is stuck either in whatever is happening in their company and they want somebody they can trust to talk to and do some thought processes to help them solve the problems they're in or perceived problem. And a lot of it, and some of it, and I guess a lot of it is probably a good word, has to do with moving up the ladder in a corporate world that's more dominated by male.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. Diversity, the funny part is diversity doesn't even come into it, because the fact that you're a woman, it's diverse, and it doesn't matter what walk of life you're in, you still have those challenges.
Yeah. And I have to say, full disclosure, I was at one of your meetings, and I had the same sense of it, that I loved the fact that there were women our age, baby boomer women, as well as those who were what we might call Generation X or millennials or whatever we want to call them. But they were women who were, in some cases, half our age. And
it was really
exciting to be with them and knowing that they were interested in knowing what we know. And it wasn't like, you're an old person, you've been through it, but your world is very different than my world, and what you have to say is irrelevant. Mm. I never got that. I got just the opposite. A true desire to want to know what we've experienced so we could kind of shortcut the route for them. And it was an amazing group of women. It really was. My hat's off to you on that one, too, because that was a great, great conversation, great experience.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did. So how long has that been going on?
Now that's on its third year also. Okay. 2014, I made all kinds of decisions. And I guess the major decision was what I was doing with the rest of my career, life, free time, non-free time. And I created two groups out of it. I left a lot of groups, but I created a lot of nonprofits, two groups that I enjoy very much because they're built on the collaboration of the members. And there's a cultural match of the members. I interview everyone personally if I don't happen to know them. And someone else then does the second interview. And they're built for women to help women. There's certain questions I ask, and they don't even know sometimes I ask them in the interview. They just answer. That really makes me think whether that woman's going to help a woman or not. You know, there's still women that don't help women.
I was just going to say that. I know that, and I'm just curious now to know, what are the questions that you would ask that would make you feel confident that this woman is someone who will help another woman?
Sometimes it depends what they're saying about something, and I go into a way of asking the second and third question. Sometimes it's what they don't say.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's their total mannerism.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
I
it's
do.
Not like I ask the question and everybody answers one way or the other. No. I was talking to a woman about she wanted to join the group, and fairly successful woman, and she got into the conversation about different things, and I threw in the question of, well, you know, how do you feel about the people that report to you? And I knew she had one woman that I had known through time that reported to her, and she kind of went on and on about something, which I'm not going to mention.
Yeah.
And I said to her, you don't like helping women. And she looked at me, she goes, no, that's why I want to join your group, so I can help women. Well, I knew darn well that it was not the truth. Because
mm-hmm.
if she didn't help women up to the moment she met me, she wasn't going to help women in those groups.
Right.
Somebody said to her, you have to help women to get along in life. That's not how you wake up to help women.
No.
Right.
No, I have to share with you this one, because this one really blew me away. I mean, I think it's very beneficial to know right at the get-go where somebody stands on that issue. But this woman left no doubt in my mind. I went to see her because somebody said to me, and this was when I was in my 30s and I was just starting out in business, and my market at the time was to be other professional women. And I think I could count on one hand the number of other professional women that there were in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Not a whole
when
lot.
I started.
Yeah.
So this woman, I finally got in to see her, and I could tell from the moment I walked in and sat down across from the desk from her, she made very little eye contact, and she was a cigarette smoker and continued to, and at the time you could do this, you know, but she just continued to smoke, and it was really getting to me, but I thought, well, you know, I'm on her territory. I can't say a whole lot. So
right.
I said something to her about what I was trying to do and that I wanted to help other women. And she is someone that I admired because she somehow got through it. And she's about, I'm saying 20 years older than me. So she was around a long time when it was just not the right thing to do for a woman to own a business. And she was single, which was even more impressive. So as we started talking about things, and I told her what I wanted to do, and I asked her for her help, she just looked straight at me. First time in the entire time I was there, looked straight at me and said, listen, I figured out how to do this, how to get around men, how to work with men. And if you think I'm going to sit here and tell you all of what I learned for the last 20 years, you're crazy. I said, okay, thank you.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Well,
now that's
amazing.
That's blatant. But, you know, as you and I both know, there are a lot of women that give lip service to that. It's when it's to their advantage, they will help another woman if they can see something in it for themselves. But in general, they are not. And I give you a lot of credit for being able to really sift that out when you're talking to people, because it's a skill.
And I'm glad I can do that, because I think many have benefited, and that's a good feeling. You know, I received 3 years ago, I received the Alice Paul Institute Equality Award, which Alice Paul was the woman that helped ratify the 19th Amendment so women could vote. And that's an honor to receive that award. But I had been to that event 2 years before when a particular woman CEO of a big conglomerate in Philadelphia had received it. And so I went up to her and said, you know, do you have a women's group in your organization? Which I knew she didn't, because I knew several women that wanted to start one and couldn't. And she said, well, do you think I'm going to help women? That was her answer. Do you think I'm going to help women?
There we are. They're
and
still
she received,
out there.
Well, what really was breaking my heart is that she received the award.
Yes.
The Alice Paul Institute Award, and yet she had that kind of thinking.
Yep.
You know?
That's not good.
So, no. So there are still those women, but I think they're a generation that's passing.
I hope so.
I think it is. I think women do not look at things like that. I think we look at each other as, you know, as comrades, as the guys do, because the guys stick together. And I think we're learning, the younger women are learning to do that.
Well, that brings me to another topic you and I said that we talked about earlier, that this current thing called the Me Too movement. I think that has been the type of thing that has truly allowed other women to feel more aligned with other women than anything else that's passed before. And just knowing that so many of us took that kind of treatment and said nothing because it was the way it was supposed to be. You just ignored it because if you said something, you had a red flag after your name. You'd never be promoted. Sure. Nothing would happen. But I think it's wonderful that this opportunity is out there now for women to find a common ground and say, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm not willing to shut my mouth and ignore this. You and I shared some experiences that you had that I absolutely loved. And I hope that you can think of some of those because these were real gems where you went through something similar to this, where because of your sexuality, your gender, that you were assumed to do certain things a certain way and incapable of doing other things. Can you share some of those?
Gee, I'm trying to think. I have all kinds of stories. Go ahead.
Well,
there's one. Just remind me which one.
There was one I was thinking about that had to do with someone who was in, I had this visual of it. That's why I could think of it. It had something to do with a guy with a truck, and you weren't supposed to be able to do something. Was it a, not a pickup truck, but a something that had to do with repairing car, like a tire or something that the guy said to you, you can't do this, and you said, yes, I can. And I forget what it was, but it was something that was really funny.
When I was out of work, when I was real young, I saw a sign at a gas station. Wanted to pump gas. And I went to the owner and I said, yeah, I can pump gas. And in those days, gas station, they also changed your oil and did some other things. But when you went and got gas, they also checked your oil. And the guy looked at me and he goes, look, you know, there is no woman in the next 50 miles that pump gas. I'm going to give you 25 cents more because of that. And so I made 25 cents more than the guys. Nice thinking. But
it usually works the other way around, doesn't it?
I know. It does. But people that came to get gas and saw that I was a woman, and it was other women that made fun of me. It was not the guys. But there was one guy who said, You have no clue on how to check the oil or do anything to my car. And I said, yes, I can. I can tune up a car. I also know how to do this, this, and that. And he just started making fun of me because I was maybe 70 pounds and he didn't think I could lift anything until I lifted something and scared him half to death and he left. So, you know.
I love it.
People just judge you for no reason at all, and especially if you're a woman pumping gas at a gas station. But and it was an honorable job, right?
Yes, and especially if you're a petite woman.
Yeah, true.
That can't even be thought of. But that was really funny, though. I loved it. Okay,
and I also worked for a trucking company.
That's
and the way I won the
trucking.
Truckers. Yes. The way I won the truckers is that because we were putting technology into their trucks is that I asked one of them to take me in their 18-wheeler. I said, no further than New York City, so I want to make sure you're coming back. And I want to know what the road's like. And that was it. I befriended them. I talked to them. You know, they're people like anybody else, and they're great people, except most women might not have done that.
Right.
I didn't like being judged, and I didn't like judging people. I accept them for who they are, and they were my best asset when it came to deploying the technology because, you know,
and before,
they were not.
Before you did that, you were not born in this country. You were born in Italy.
I was born in Milan, Italy.
And how old were you or how young were you when you came to this country?
I was almost 9 years old, and we came over in 1955 through New York City Harbor. Ellis Island was closed then, closed in 52 or 53. So we came through the harbor. And the first thing I saw that night, because we got in around 11 o'clock, and we all had to board the ship by 12. Otherwise, you're stuck there all night. And the first thing I saw was the Statue of Liberty. And that was an awesome sight.
Yeah. And did you travel with family, or was it just you?
My mother, myself, and my sister. My mother picked up, was able to be sponsored by my aunt that was here to come to America because there wasn't much left. You know, 55 was still after the war, and a lot of things were still destroyed. And it was hard for women to find work because the men came back, rightfully so. They needed their jobs. My father had passed away, so there was not much holding her at that point. And my aunt got us passage here, and she started a new life with two girls, probably scared out of her mind, and worked in a factory. And I don't know how she did it, but she definitely is on a high pedestal in our family.
I'll bet. And what did she teach you, if anything, about money?
She was very, obviously, you know, I had 10 cents in my pocket throughout high school, and that was in case I had an emergency phone call. She was very, you know, she was not cheap. That's interesting. There's a difference between frugal and cheap.
Yeah.
She knew that she only had so much money to stretch. She knew how to stretch the money. She taught us the value of the money, but she also taught us that there's value in things that are good, and sometimes you have to stretch that dollar to get that because it's more valuable than just buying cheap. Thus, I happen to buy very good clothes that I keep for a long time because everything I buy has to be altered anyway. So I learned the quality, and she was a seamstress, so the quality of material,
okay.
Yes, and how things fit. So she, you know, I found out later that people in high school thought I was rich because my shoes were polished, my uniform was always pressed, and I ate with a knife and a fork. I didn't know how to eat a sandwich. So,
no kidding.
Well, yeah, we didn't eat sandwiches. We ate with a knife and a fork.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
So, that's interesting. And
yeah.
Did you eat the European way where you use the fork
still
in
do.
Your left hand?
Yes.
Do you really?
Yeah, I still do. Yeah, I still
I
eat with
it.
A knife and a fork.
Okay. So what did you learn, though, about saving money? Did you have an opportunity to do that? You said you got a job working with pumping gas, but before that, did you have any part-time job? Were you able to do something with the money?
I started working in 66, and I started working actually when I was in high school. 65, so 65, and I worked at Two Guys, which is kind of like a Kmart and all that stuff, because I wanted to have money in my pocket. And I went to work right after high school because basically I got tired of being poor, and I figured, and I got it, and it was easier then with a high school degree to get a job, and technology was the easiest way for me to get a job in technology because you didn't have to speak English that well, because I had an accent way into my 30s. It just kind of left in my 30s because I went to college in my 30s, so I began to read and write and speak a lot more English than I spoke Italian. So, but I went to work right after high school, and then decided when I was 30 years old, I woke up and said, you know what, I think I need a college degree. Ended up getting two degrees and a couple of majors and a couple of minors. Because I got on a roll, you know. Anytime you get on a roll, don't stop it, right? And I had
so
some
what
great,
are the degrees in?
One's computer science, the other one's management accounting, and then I took sociology, psychology, philosophy, and music.
Wow. That makes you a Renaissance woman.
Makes me kind of nutsy because when I think about it, I slept 4 hours, worked for full-time at Deloitte.
Wow.
And went to school from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock at night and all through the summer for the 3.5 years I did it.
Wow. Kudos to you. All right.
When you're driven.
You're
driving.
You're driven.
Right. Yeah. That's
so
one of the things. Go ahead.
What was the driving motivation for you to do this? I mean, it's one thing to say, I think I need a college degree, but there's another thing to do it the way you did it in 3.5 years. And wow, what prompted that?
I was learning so much that I couldn't stop. I was learning so many things that I didn't know I knew, and things that I didn't know that I should have known. And I knew that I wanted to be self-sustaining. I didn't want to depend on corporations to give me jobs. I began to learn pretty fast that I needed to do something else. And in 82, I opened up a company, which I had for 10 years, and then sold it. So I knew that as long as I could work for corporate, and if I lost my job, I could start a company. I knew I could always be independent.
Yeah.
And I think the driving force for everything was have good finances, be independent, manage your money, be able to retire. I mean, I'll probably retire when I'm 80 and be comfortable. Even though if I win $1 billion, there's so many causes. There's two causes I'd like to work on and help out. So I would use the money for charity.
Okay. And what are those
for? For humanity. One is the Answers to Alzheimer's. I think it's out there. It's just not here. And the other one is children. Children are the pivot of where the world is going to continue going on a positive spin.
And what aspect of that do you want to get involved with children?
Education. Education is not quite there in educating children, because sometimes I also think of educating people past 50 because they missed the boat on a few things. But I think I picked the word children. Yeah, children, because I was reading an article about children. But yeah, I think I would go Alzheimer's for sure, because cancer, we're getting to the bottom of it, and diabetes and all the other ones, transplants, but Alzheimer's, solving that would be a godsend.
Sure would.
Yeah.
It sure would. All right. Well, I hate to say time's up, but it is. So I want to say again, thanks to my guest, Candida Seesuck. And to all of you in my Power the Purse community, I hope today's podcast was helpful in enriching your understanding of money and how it can help you achieve your goals. If you'd like to spend 15 minutes on a call with me and ask me questions about your personal finances, please go to my website, powerofthepursepodcast.com, select the contact tab, and find a time that works for you. Thanks again, Candida, for sharing your time and your knowledge, and let everybody know how they can reach you.
Yes, you can call me at 609-471-1188. And or my email, my personal email is pjscts@comcast.net, pjscts@comcast.net. Or you can text me and I'll give you a time when I can call you back.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay.
I appreciate
that. All right.
Take care.
And until the next time, thanks for listening. And remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Goodbye until next time.
Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.